So we're going to look at the 11 modes of by which the Bodhisattva accomplishes the welfare of sentient beings. We'll try and look at three today, if I can discipline myself enough. So we're on page 5, the third paragraph, that's the second full paragraph. Furthermore, there are 11 modes by which the Bodhisattva is established in the ethics of accomplishing the welfare of sentient beings in all its modes. He is possessed of each mode, and he is possessed of all. Okay? Now, the first mode is the next two paragraphs. And it's basically the Bodhisattva helps. He's helpful, or she is helpful. Just does what's necessary to help people around. So, I'll read out what it says. The Bodhisattva renders assistance by assessing the needs and deciding what is to be done to minister to the various needs of sentient beings, by being a travelling companion, by employment in good work, by guarding property, by reconciling the divided, by festivity, and by meritorious deeds. Somewhat miscellaneous list. Furthermore, the Bodhisattva ministers to the suffering. He nurses sentient beings stricken by illness. He guides the blind and shows them the way. The deaf he makes to understand by hand language, teaching them signs as names. Those without limbs he transports on top of him by conveyance. He dispels the suffering of involvement in sense desire for sentient beings who suffer involvement in sense desire. He dispels the preoccupation with objects of desire of sentient beings who suffer involvement in preoccupation with objects of desire. As with preoccupation with objects of desire, someone should understand preoccupation with ill will, injury, kinfolk, fellow countrymen, and deities, as well as preoccupation connected with repudiation and family prosperity. He dispels the suffering of humiliation and defeat by others from sentient beings who suffer humiliation and defeat by others. He dispels the suffering of exhaustion from those who are road weary by giving them a place to stay and a seat and by massaging their limbs. It's delightful, isn't it? Little sort of insights into second century India and its culture. Although a lot of it is quite relevant. So yes, the basic point is being helpful, just helping people when they need help. But the text starts with some very important preliminaries, or the section starts with very important preliminaries. The Bodhisattva renders assistance by assessing the needs and deciding what is to be done to minister to the various needs. So assessing the needs, this is really important because some people are too helpful and, as it were, almost mindlessly helpful. They rush too quickly to help. They take on too quickly the sufferings of others. It's a matter to some extent of character and disposition. Some people feel the needs of others very, very intensely. Perhaps a little bit more common amongst women than men because of obviously the sort of mother feeling just to help, although it's not possible to generalize. But often people want to help out of a slightly sort of, there's something selfish in it. It's too much of an identification, too uncontained, too anxious. It's not a calm assessment of what really is needed and of how to fulfill that need. Sometimes that calm assessment of the need may mean that you realize you cannot help and that even it's not the best thing for you to help. You may need to help somewhere else, as it were. For instance, because I work in India, I'm very well aware of the issues in India. For instance, there's a great deal of casteism, that is caste prejudice especially towards those lowest in the caste hierarchy. And there's a huge amount of atrocity. So what do you do? How do you deal with it? There's a need, a very clear need. People need protection. They need somebody to stand up for them. But how do you do it, especially when it's on such a vast scale? Well, I'm not going to try to give you an answer. I'm just sort of saying this is a problem that confronts my friends in India all the time. There are big incidents that happen. There's some going on right now. Students being sort of picked on by the university authorities, and it's fairly clear there's caste basis for this. So what do you do? How do you deal with it most intelligently? Of course, what people tend to do is they rush out, they start protesting and so forth, and it simply creates further tensions. Sometimes that has to be done. Sometimes you have to draw attention to what is happening so that it is people become aware of it. Sometimes you have to work in other ways. And as I say, I've no idea how to deal with it. It's beyond me. But often what you may have to decide is, well, actually we're going to have to work in a slower and deeper way. We're going to have to work on the bases of casteism. This is what Dr. Ambedkar concluded. He did conclude that there needed to be a direct confrontation, so to speak, with the manifestations of casteism. But he thought there needed to be a much deeper work to, first of all, change the mentality of those who are subject to that prejudice, make them more self-confident, make them stand up for themselves, help them to take responsibility for dealing with it themselves, but also trying to change the whole mentality, the whole cultural context in India, which he thought that the Buddha Dhamma was the best means to do it. And often that really is the longest, the best, although the slowest and most intangible way of doing it. We need to change the underlying culture, the mentality that leads to prejudices of all sorts. We have our own prejudices in these shores. How do you deal with them? You deal with them directly, you deal with them politically, but you need to deal with them more in terms of the framework of thought, the framework of attitude and idea. And that is where you need to work in terms of the Dhamma, to try to create a different sort of mentality. And it's slow work, it's long work, and it may not be successful. Do you see what I mean? So you need to assess the needs. There's immediate needs. You see somebody being beaten up, you do what you can to stop it. If you can't do it yourself, you try to get help to stop it. If you see a pattern, you try to get some sort of political involvement, some sort of response to it through government and so forth. Not always easy. But in the longer run, you need to recognize that these sorts of prejudices and the violence that comes from them have deeper roots. I'm just off to Hungary next week to work with our Roma gypsy mitras there. Well, I'm not working with them. I'm just encouraging them. They're doing the work. But they are working within a situation of extreme right-wing nationalism, which is more or less explicitly anti-Gypsy, anti-Jew. Less overt about Jews, because that's much more easy, much less easy to get away with, but more or less explicitly anti-Gypsy. And, well, they're having to work in that context. And, of course, they're doing it mainly, following Dr. Ambedkar's example, by encouraging young Roma to get educated and thereby to have the tools to get a job, to get influential positions, and to be able to deal with what's happening intelligently and confidently. But also they're trying to engage with the wider situation in order to change that. So we need to assess the needs carefully in the largest and deepest context, as well as in the most immediate context. If you are being beaten up, I hope I would not say, I think I need to change British culture and leave you to take the blows. I hope I would, as Lytton Strachey said, interpose my body between you and them or whatever. I hope that I would take some active step, at least to yell help. But we need to be also looking at the deeper structure of the problem, the deeper circumstances, the deeper conditions out of which it comes. So assessing the needs and deciding what is to be done is a very important part of this whole bodhisattva approach. Otherwise, one simply becomes exhausted through trying to sticking plaster on innumerable wounds while the source of those wounds is not dealt with. I find this a really fruitful sort of reflection because in visiting, you know, in Britain, I'm sort of used to the circumstances, and the suffering is less obvious to me because one's sort of kind of grown up with it, as it were. But in India, it's much more obvious to me, and it's much rawer. And one has to sort of assess what one's doing in the light of the problems that you see around you. And I've personally taken great guidance from Dr. Ambedkar's own work, because he suffered from those prejudices, and he came to the conclusion that the deepest and best response to them, apart from the political and the social, was the Dhamma, was a new ethical perspective, an ethical basis for society. So yes, this rendering assistance by assessing the needs and deciding what is to be done is something that every one of us needs to come to some conclusion about, so that we can work out what to do on a day-by-day basis and feel that what we are doing is a contribution. Again, I think it's important to recognize that I cannot save all sentient beings. I can barely save anybody. It's way beyond me. But I can participate in a community that is itself contributing to the resolution of things, and that is part of a larger trend within society at large to cope with things, to deal with things. We have to put ourselves on the side of the good, if you like, and to align with others very deeply so that we are working together to do what we can. I think, for instance, sitting in this incredible new retreat centre, which is done to a very high standard, and in which we've chosen to spend more money than was strictly, as it were, necessary. Do you know what I mean? We could have got a few caravans and parked them in the fields. I don't think we could, actually, but, say for the sake of argument, we could have done that. Maitri Vadri is looking at me with horror. But we've chosen to not spend a huge amount more than it takes to build such buildings, but we've chosen to do it really well, and to do it as beautifully as we can, and to do it in a way that manifests principles. We've done that not just because we like a nice environment for retreats, we do, but we believe that in doing so, we will be able to communicate something that will be of larger benefit. Not everybody will come here, but those who do come here will gain something, will get some experience that they'll carry back with them, and that we hope that they will use to help others. So even in putting quite a lot of work and effort and resources into building something beautiful and in which the values are embodied in the very walls, we're doing that conscious of the larger task, if you see what I mean. If you're not conscious of that larger task, you're merely indulging in aestheticism, this sort of personal enjoyment of a nice environment. This is the great sort of danger for the rich the world over, the middle class danger, that we build for ourselves a really nice life, which it's not a bad thing. I hope people do have a nice life, but we do it ignoring the suffering around us and without any relationship to that suffering, or a minimal relationship, a little bit of gift aid or whatever, but without really seeing what we are doing in that larger context. And again, I see this so clearly in India, where there's a very large Indian middle class, some of whom, even perhaps many of whom, are very conscious of their responsibility to the larger society. But very, very many are not. They're just busy with their own nice life, even though right next door to them on the platform is somebody who is starving. And I'm only using them as an example because it's easier to talk about other people. But we're doing the same here. We're doing the same here. And actually, even in Britain as a whole, our wealth, our comfortable life is largely as a result of colonial exploitation. We're the beneficiaries of exploitation, which led to famine in Bengal, etc., etc., etc. So I'm not saying then we need to get horrifiedly guilty, but we need to live our lives in relation to the world around us and its suffering. So if we do make for ourselves something beautiful, we should do it in the consciousness that this can be a contribution, not just in the consciousness, with the definite intention that this should be of more broad benefit, wider benefit. And I hope we do. I hope we do. I hope we're conscious that what we do is impacting more widely. And I hope we're deliberately trying to make it impact more widely. So, yes, assessing the needs and deciding what is to be done is the most important part, really, of this aspect, this mode of the Bodhisattva's activity. And then he just gives some, the Asanga gives some very plain, straightforward ones, being a travelling companion. And so it now comes down to me and my activity in the world. A friend doesn't want to travel alone. In Britain, it seems a ridiculous thing. But, if you live in most countries in the world, travelling on your own is dangerous. It's also sort of lonely because it can be a long journey under difficult circumstances. So you want people with you. I've definitely had circumstances where people have said, do you want somebody to come with you? Do you want me to come with you? Just out of a desire to support me. So that's what's implied here. This is sort of a very pertinent example, not necessarily one you'll come across, but it illustrates the point. Employment in good work. Well, hardly need to say anything, do we? So many people in the world do not have work. They don't have the opportunity for work, let alone good work. Many of my friends in India worked in the ammunition factory. Buddhists sort of doing metta bhavana, making ammunition. Well, I don't believe that a country in the modern situation can do without some sort of army and police and so forth. But it's difficult if you're, practicing Buddhist, practicing to any deep extent, to be in that sort of situation. So right livelihood, giving people work, trying to find work for people that is beneficial to them. Guarding property. Again, in Britain, it seems a bit strange, doesn't it, on the whole? But in many places, it's not. Many places in the world, if you don't guard your property, thieves will break in. People will take it over. I've had that happen to friends of mine in Bihar. They've just had their land taken. Nothing they can do about it because of political support, police are not, etc. So you need to guard land. And so you can help friends in that way. Reconciling the divided. Whoa, wow, you could spend your life doing this. And a good thing. People quarrel. And sometimes those quarrels become really dangerous and difficult and can cause a lot of suffering. By festivity. This is a strange one, isn't it? What it means is creating convivial situations, not situations where people get, what was the phrase I used the other day, rat-arsed, but situations where people are just happy together. I was here for the weekend, the opening weekend, and of course it had a very deep meaning and purpose. But one of the things that really struck me was people were just happy to come together in this sort of context, in this situation. And, you know, sometimes having a party, an innocent party, where you just come together with friends and especially to celebrate something, somebody's birthday or some special occasion, has a very, very beneficial social effect and a very uplifting effect on people. And especially, I think, if those festivities are connected with something of value, connected with value. So a Buddha Day, Sangha Day, Dhamma Day, these are important contributions to people's lives because they give them an opportunity for positive social connection, which is often quite lacking in the modern circumstance, the modern situation, particularly with larger numbers of people. You know, football matches used to be, on the whole, I believe, from friends who told me about it, quite positive occasions. You'd all be there and there'd be a very strong sense of solidarity. And friends have told me that they were part of the joy of it was not just watching the team win or lose. It was just being with everybody else and enjoying the roar of all those voices together. And I think that's a fairly innocent thing until it ceases to be innocent and you start a bundle with the other side. But in itself, it's not a bad thing. But we have so few occasions now for that actual presence together. All our festivity is virtual. We participate in virtual public occasions. So I think it's one of the things that a centre really importantly provides, occasions for festivity. By meritorious deeds. So what's been got at here is looking to helping people to get the basics of a good life, doing what you can immediately to respond to people's needs and doing what you can, as it were, politically, socially, dhammically, to create the conditions in which people can find those needs. And as part of our purpose in our Sangha, is to create those needs create the response to those needs so that more and more people can take advantage of them. I think one of the things that I would like to see around any centre, and I'm beginning to see it around the LBC, is, for instance, the creation of opportunities for work, beneficial work, together. I think that's really important. I'd like to see a centre doing much more just to respond to the immediate needs we see around us in the society. A lot of people are struggling at the moment because of the cutbacks in social welfare, whether one argues those are necessary or not. They're a fact. And at the centre, I think, any Buddhist community should be doing something to respond to those sort of needs. And again, assessing them clearly and accurately and doing what can be done for them. And I know some people do this, but I think should be sort of part of the life of the centre. So even if I can't do it myself, I know it's being done. And I'm part of the system, so to speak, the total community that does that. Indeed, I think that when we're talking about all of this, don't think about me. Don't think about me rendering assistance. Think about us rendering assistance. Think about working together to meet these needs. Think about creating a community that is responsive to the needs of the world around us. Of course, responsive to the needs of people amongst us, but it's responsive to the needs of the world around us. We're at the very, very early stages of this, I think, in our movement. Understandably, necessarily, no blame. But I think we need to become collectively a kind of bodhisattva. I think actually, personally, I can't be a bodhisattva. But if I'm participating with others, I can be part of the bodhisattva, if you see what I mean. So I think the LBC, if I may say so, Mr. Chairman, I think the LBC should be thinking of itself, developing more and more of a bodhisattva sort of spirit. It does already, but thinking of itself more and more in that way, so that every one of us can feel we are responding to all these 11 modes and contributing it in our own way to the needs that these modes are directed to. So I think it'd be very good if any centre had a sort of stock take. What are the needs around us and how can we respond to them? What are the needs amongst us and how can we respond to them? And of course, there's a larger question, what are the needs of the world and how can we respond to that? Goes on to talk about suffering, helping those who are stricken by illness. Well, it's certainly very obvious amongst us, isn't it? If anybody's ill, there should be an immediate sort of coming together of the Sangha to help. But we should be supporting, an effective health service. For instance, we should be making sure that where people don't get looked after, we're agitating at least that they are, and so on. So maybe part of the same assessment of needs. Guiding the blind and showing them the way. This is quite interesting, isn't it? Care of the disabled or whatever, or less abled, which I think one of the wonderful things about modern Britain, which I rejoice in. There is provision, statutory provision, for the care for people who are less able. I think that is a very civilised thing. But we should make sure that, yes, this is happening within our own community. I know one or two order members who've learnt sign language so that they can teach deaf people the Dhamma. It's interesting that the text from the second century talks about sign language. That shows you the spirit of it. You get very much this sort of spirit in the rock edicts of Ashoka. They really manifest this sort of spirit. For instance, the provision of hospitals for sick animals in 3rd century BC, India. But then it comes on to more mental suffering, dispelling the suffering of involvement with sense desires, so helping people to overcome craving, intense craving. And I'm not going to go through the complete list because I need to do 11 modes in 2.5 hours. But basically, it's in the end, it's to do with meditation, isn't it? It's teaching people through meditation how to deal with their minds. I think this is what our mindfulness-based trainings of various kinds, breathing space, is trying to do. Help people to deal with addiction, for instance, which is a form of intense craving, through working on the mind. This is part of our bodhisattva activity, which is connected, of course, with a deeper practice of the Dhamma. But it's in the first place, we don't care whether people come into the Dhamma or not. We just want them to get over the suffering that's involved in addiction or in stress or whatever it may be, or depression. So we're helping people to deal with their suffering. And it's one of the ways in which the LBC certainly does minister to the needs of beings. I particularly touched, I don't know whether we're still doing it, but we did that work for carers Well, we're still doing it. Because, well, if you're a carer, it's often a very lonely and circumscribed life. And I know that people, when they've come on retreats here, and it'll be even more the case when they come on retreat here, they get so much that really supports them in this work that they have to do, which sometimes can lead you to the limits of patience, where you're just doing what you've got to do, even though you don't want to do it, because there's nothing feeding you. So these sorts of work are really important, helping people to deal with their minds, training them, helping them to work with their own minds. Yeah, objects of desire, ill will, injury. How do you deal with injustice? It's again something I've come across much more commonly in India, where people have been subject to injustice upon injustice upon injustice, unimaginable injustice, especially because of caste, and where doors have been closed in their face from the moment they're born because of just where they happen to be born. And how do you deal with it? You know, sometimes it's overwhelming. So you have to try to help them to gain the confidence to deal with it themselves. There's a big incident in India at the moment where a Dalit student was suspended from his university completely unjustly. He's accused of something he did not do, and where there are plenty of witnesses to say he did not do it, suspended from his university. He committed suicide and he left a note saying, "I know people will think I'm being a coward, but I've experienced this for 25 years and I cannot go on. From my birth, I've experienced this." And, well, it made me very, very sort of sad indeed that that person did not have the connections that would give him the confidence and courage to face what was happening to him. Interestingly enough, his mother, because there was a huge national outcry over this, it became a sort of national cause célèbre. His mother got a lot of help, and she got a lot of help from Buddhists, and she converted to Buddhism. Because she felt that in Buddhism there was the courage, the confidence, especially through Dr. Ambedkar, to face this constant repression of aspiration. So people suffer injury upon injury upon injury, and I'm sure it happens in Britain too for various reasons. And people need to feel they're in connection with somebody who can give them the confidence to face this constant battering that life gives them, that society gives them. You know, so many people commit suicide in Britain, and there's, I believe, a sort of crisis amongst men, especially amongst working class men, because they feel no sense of hope, no sense of wider horizon. Well, we should be responding to that in some way. I don't know how. Should assess the need and find the way to respond. That people from all parts of society suffer from this helplessness, this hopelessness. Whew, I could go on. Humiliation. Whew. Humiliation is dreadful, isn't it? And especially in a circumstance where there's a more traditional society where your face matters. I've seen this in India again. I'm sorry to keep giving these examples from India, but it's a traditional society in a relatively poor country. So a lot is exposed that is more disguised in Britain. But if you come from a traditional society, any humiliation is much, much more powerful because you lose your social face. You can't hold your head up in society. In Britain, you know, you do something and, well, you just move. Or anyway, nobody knows you, or you just change your profile on Facebook, or whatever it is, invent a new identity for yourself. And anyway, nobody really cares that much. But humiliation, especially social humiliation, is crippling. I've seen people's lives ruined through it. So helping people to find a deeper source of confidence, a deeper source of courage, is an extremely important function. Helping people to realize that the Dhamma, that humiliation is relatively superficial. For instance, a friend of mine, an Indian friend of mine, his wife left him with another guy. And in India, that is, for a man, a complete loss of social identity. Couldn't even keep his wife. That's what people will say. You know, couldn't satisfy his wife is what they're saying, really. It's very, very difficult to hold your head up. And he said that, to begin with, he just thought, I'll end it. I'll just jump under a train. But he was in contact with the Dhamma, and he had Dhamma friends, and they began to help him to see that actually there was a deeper meaning to him, a deeper source of confidence that he had to find. And, he did do it, and he's one of our leading order members now. But it humiliation of that kind requires a sort of courage and confidence and depth that is quite unusual, and that the Dhamma can help you to gain. Anyway, massaging their limbs. There we are. That's an easy one. Come up to something like that. I'm not going to go through every detail here. Okay, you get the point. See what the needs are. See what you, as a community, can do. How we can work together. And not just as the LBC's Sangha, but also with other Sanghas, even other Sanghas of Tri Ratna, but other Sanghas, other Buddhist Sanghas, other non-Buddhist communities, working with people of goodwill to confront the sufferings of the world. But intelligently, putting one's efforts where they're going to be most effective, and if possible, collectively. Let's become a bodhisattva. I remember this when I was involved in the building project at the LBC. I had a sort of vision of the bodhisattva of the LBC. We didn't call it LBC at that time, but the bodhisattva of this sort of project, as if it was a being, not very clearly seen, but of a sort of consciousness that was manifesting slowly through the bricks and mortar that we were hammering together so inexpertly, and through those early classes where we were doing our best, and again inexpertly, to connect with the people coming along. A sort of glimpse of something, a consciousness beyond my own, our own, that was trying to sort of manifest through us. So I think that's what ultimately we need to think of, that rendering assistance, responding to the needs, is something collective which calls upon resources beyond us. Okay, that's one mode. You might think that's enough and you want to go and lie down now. But let's see if we can get another one under our belts. Oh, I doubt it. Furthermore, the Bodhisattva teaches sentient beings with relevancy. To eliminate misbehavior in sentient beings who course in misbehavior, he teaches them doctrine with literary expression that is fitting, connected, congruent, coherent, skillful, appropriate, compliant, and painstakingly resourceful. That's what I should be doing at this very moment. I'll leave it to you to give me marks out of 10. Looking at it in another way, he teaches with skill in means. To eliminate misbehavior in sentient beings who course in misbehavior, he will, for example, to eliminate stinginess, miserliness, in the stingy, teach them with skill and means how to correctly and with little difficulty and acquire and keep good goods in this life. Those who are hostile to this Buddhist teaching, he causes to obtain faith, to obtain vision, and by purifying their views, to rise above a bad rebirth, and eventually to transcend all suffering by making an end of all fetters. Okay, easy. Go and do it. The point here is that the Bodhisattva individually, the Bodhisattva collectively, tries to find the best means of reaching people. So if you're speaking to people, if you're teaching, you try to find a way of teaching that does the job, that really gets through to people, that really reaches them, helps them to see what they must do. That's the job I should be doing. I hate talking about this sort of thing while I'm doing it, because it puts me again to the question. But this is very much prized in the Bodhisattva tradition. It's sometimes spoken of as rhetoric, but rhetoric often in our modern language means using tricks to get your point across. But what it means here is having a sincere message that you really want to communicate, and painstakingly trying to find the best means of doing it, trying to really get across what you're trying to communicate, studying how to communicate, learning how to teach, learning what works, what doesn't work, learning from your failures, learning from your successes, becoming expert in communication. This doesn't mean expert in communication in the sort of cynical sense of studying what works and what doesn't work so that you can manipulate people. Like, the greatest experts in communication in the modern era are advertising agencies. They really study how to get their message to us. And they're brilliant at it. Unfortunately, often rather cynically, perhaps, from our point of view. But we need to be studying how to get our message, this liberating message that helps people to deal with their suffering, helps them to overcome misbehavior, in other words, unskillful activity, but by helping them to understand, well, why that's unskillful and how to act better. Helping people who despise the Dhamma how to have a higher perspective on life. This really means finding ways to deal with what in Buddhism we call wrong views, mithya drishti or mithya ditti, wrong views, wrong attitudes that harm you and harm others, attitudes to life, understandings of life that cause you to suffer and others to suffer. And modern life is riddled with wrong views. I've slightly overextended myself, so my mind isn't readily reaching for wrong views. But for instance, the idea that you can dispense with ethics in a Dhamma life. The idea that the main thing is insight. And if you can get insight, all the else falls into place. This is a Buddhist wrong view. Well, it doesn't. If you don't have a broader basis, your insight is not really insight. It might be a glimpse, it might be a parting of the curtain, but it's not really insight. So there are lots and lots of wrong views amongst Buddhists. The idea that this life is all there is. The end of life, that's it. That, for Buddhists, is a major wrong view. The failure to realize there's more to you than the body. There's something about you which carries on. This, for Buddhists, is a major wrong view. The idea that all it is atoms and molecules banging together in a sort of random way, producing a momentary glow, like tungsten when the current passes through it, which is awareness, and then it goes out, and that's it. That idea is probably the widest and most commonly held perspective, the materialist perspective in the literal sense. There are more functional materialism in the sense of consumerism. The idea that the iPhone, what number are we up to now? Of course, nobody here knows, do they? But the iPhone X now will really be better than the iPhone Y and will really give you a greater degree of happiness. Of course, we don't say that, but we do subtly believe it. We believe the consumer project. I always say that consumerism is the greatest and most effective religion the world has ever known, because it actually delivers its promises, or at least appears to. If you perform the sacrament of getting out your piece of plastic, you will get the reward that it promises. You can, take the sacrament in all sorts of other ways. It won't necessarily work, but with consumerism, if you pay, you will get. And you will get a momentary feeling of real satisfaction and happiness. People don't understand that. They don't understand what the whole economy is based on. It's a trick. It's a deception. A consciously, sedulously maintained trick that they play with the fact that you get some benefit when you get the new thing. I know, I do it myself. You know, you get your new package from Amazon, you open it up, and you feel great. And you want to show everybody, and particularly if they don't have one. And then, blow me down, they get a better one. And, again, this is consciously manipulated, you begin to feel, I would be happy if I had that. So there's wrong views of this kind, which are sort of much more unconscious. None of us would sign up to that openly, but which depend upon a more fundamental set of views, which is that actually material things are all there is, so better get the best ones you can before the lights go out. These sort of wrong views are very widely held. Very strong suspicions, we talked about it yesterday, of anything that purports to come from a higher level, be of a greater quality. So these wrong views are widespread. We all have them within us. They're there being broadcast to us, literally, in the films we watch, in the programs we see, in the advertisements that surround us, in the shape of the buildings. A shopping mall is a giant teaching. You go there and look at it from that point of view. It's a giant teaching. It's all here. Buy and you will be saved. It's a giant church to the religion of consumerism. The shape of the building. Architects, who are very clever people, they know how to embody value and meaning in buildings. And the building itself is broadcasting that. I think, actually, architects are the most powerful people in the world. I'm sure Maitri Vajri will agree with me. Because the building is something you occupy all the time. The television programme comes and goes. The building you're in all the time. So the shape of the high street, the shape of the shops, the shape of the mall, etc., is communicating. Communicating values in the sense of a meaning which is underlain by a glorious wrong view. It's so different to the classical the environment of traditional society, where of course the temple dominates the skyline. You know, like in Norwich, I lived in Padmalloka for quite a long time, and you go out onto the marshes, and you see 5 miles away, 6 miles away, the spire of the cathedral. And, you know, whether you agree with those principles or not, there it was, a message all the time at the centre of life. And the whole annual calendar would be based upon those religious principles. So we live in an environment of ideas, of underlying assumptions and views, view perspectives. And the Bodhisattva is consciously trying to break through those wrong views and communicate right views. Those right views have to ultimately be transcended in no view, in the direct perception of reality. But the right view helps us to get to direct perception of reality. So the Bodhisattva is studying means of communicating. The Bodhisattva should be, forgive my metaphor, the best advertising agent ever. Should have studied the way in which language works, should have studied the way in which language impacts upon the human heart, should have studied how to communicate in the best possible way. Of course, in the end, what really counts is sincerity. What really counts in the end is sincerity and your own understanding. But between that sincerity and understanding, skill helps. And the Bodhisattva is enjoined to study as much as he or she can how best to communicate. That's why at the OBC there's a mentoring program for teachers. Teachers always are inducted into leading classes and so forth. And efforts are made to get feedback on how teaching is going and so on. So that we get the best way of getting it across possible. And we should constantly be studying how effective we are and how much we're reaching people. We should be reaching more and more people of a wider and wider range, so we don't just appeal to people like us, which is what often happens. We're just talking to people like us. So this is the second of the Bodhisattva's 11 modes. There's so much to say about it. In fact, this list of, what is it? Fitting, connected, congruent, coherent, skillful, appropriate, compliant, and painstakingly resourceful is extremely interesting, because each of these is pointing to a different quality in communication. So, for instance, fitting means that what you're saying really fits what you're trying to communicate, if you see what I mean. So that you're not just sort of talking about something and it doesn't really get to or connect with what you're trying to say. Can happen, I assure you. I've rambled enough. Connected, so that the words and the meaning are connected. They're connected to each other, congruent, so that it all adds up, it all fits together, so you don't feel when you're listening, well, he's talking about that. Now he's talking about that. You can't see how it all adds up, because that just you lose any sense of relevancy. Coherent, so that from beginning to end, it all makes sense. Skillful. It's positive. The communication is positive. If negative things are referred to, they're referred to in a positive context. And the skill in the sense of craftsman's skill in getting it across. So you're attracted to what's being spoken about. Appropriate, compliant, painstakingly resourceful. Let's not labour it. Painstakingly resourceful. You know, so when I'm talking to you, I need to be constantly seeing, are you getting it? Are you interested? Are you following it? I have to be sort of examining whether I'm getting through, and if I'm not, I need to find another way of doing it. I need to reflect on what's going on. Do my best. Anyway, hastening on from this rather too close to the bone topic, for one who's giving a talk, that's what you should be doing. The Bodhisattva should be trying to get the message across in the way that really reaches people. Talking to people with what they need to hear. You know, the best thing you hear when you've given a talk is people come up to you and say, I feel you were talking just to me. Then you know you've succeeded. Because you know the person feels that what you are saying connects with their real needs. And It touches them precisely, and it's the most sort of satisfying feeling you can get. You don't know them from Adam or Eve, but you somehow touched on something sort of universal or human that connects with them. That's what you're trying to do. And the effect of what you do should be to release people from their unskillful behavior, should help them to live a more moral, more ethical life. It should help them to deal with their mental states so that they're in more and more skillful mental states. And it should help them to be freed from their fundamental delusions about who they are and what life is. It should bring them, indeed, to insight. So there we are. That's just two modes. And we'll follow the other nine tomorrow. I have to try and restrain myself because I do want to finish them all. There you go.